Welcome, everyone. Addiction counselors work every day to help their clients get on the road to recovery. But what happens when an addiction counselor or someone in this field needs to help a family member plagued by addiction? My guest today, Angelina Grip, is the clinical director for Tres Vistas Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center in San Clemente, California, and the co-host of the Recovery Show on KOCI 101.5 FM. Angelina has a teenage son who has struggled with addiction and is now living a successful and sober life. Angelina is here today to talk to us about how her professional training and experience helped her with an intensely personal fight against addiction. And she's here to kind of discuss the roles of the families in treatment and how she brings her unique personal understanding of addiction into her everyday work with clients. Angelina, welcome to the show. I'm so grateful to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And it's such, you know, it takes such courage to share your own personal experience. And I think it's so wonderful because you have the professional experiences just being in this industry. And then also, of course, when it comes to your personal life, it's always different, I'm sure.
You know, it really is. When my son is 20 years old now, and he's now 15 months sober as of today.
Fantastic.
Every day is. Yeah, it is, and every day is a celebration when it comes to sobriety, as those who have sobriety know. But when he actually was struggling, I was pretty new in the industry, and my training definitely helped. I guess later on, but in the very beginning, it was really important for me to put being a mother first.
Of course, right. And you know, I know as professionals, even if you were just beginning, you know, we understand what boundaries are. We have to implement them. We have to, you know, of course, teach people how to communicate and how we want to be treated. And I know that must be very difficult when it is a personal relationship like this, being someone's mother, and really trying to separate yourself as from the professional to someone that is so heart centered around this kind of, you know, experience.
You're right. And I think I found is I was able to help other people, and every day I was going to work, and I was working with young men at the time, and I was going to work and I was helping them, and I was coming home and I was seeing my own son showing a lot of the signs and the symptoms that I was talking about every day. And I wasn't able to get past, you know, he wasn't communicating with me. And so what I had to do was reach out to somebody else. You know, cause you have your suspicions as a parent, and, you know, I think trust your gut instinct when it comes to wondering what's going on with your child. I think that's probably, you know, some good advice to give people, because we're really close as parents, and we become enablers without realizing it. And even myself, as you know, with all the training and experience I had, you know, that kind of went out the window when I came home, and it was really, really tough. I would come home, I would have my suspicions, but then I would also say to myself, "No, it can't be. My son can't be doing this." And I ended up having to go to someone else and say, "You know, can you talk to my son? Can you maybe have a conversation with him? I'm not sure. I think he might be," because there was a blinders that come on when you're a mom, when you're a dad, when you're a loved one.
Right.
And,
absolutely.
Right. I know when I talk to family members today, families, you know, family sessions, family support is so important as part of the recovery process. There's a lot of guilt and blame and self-blame that, you know, occurs. You know, why didn't I see it? I'm so close. How could I not have known? And a lot of the reasons are for that, because we are so close. But yeah, I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, but I just, you know, it's something I'm very passionate about, being a mom. And
no, absolutely. No, and this is, but this is all such wonderful things to talk about, because I hear this every day. And what I do always get asked, which, you know, maybe you could help shed some light on this. What are the red flags? You know, I have mothers and fathers constantly calling me and saying, you know, my son is or daughter's isolating, or, you know, they're not taking care of themselves like they used to, or they're acting out and not communicating, or they're hanging out with people that I feel are, you know, not healthy or troublesome kids. You know, these are all red flags, but you know, I just don't think anybody knows what to look for. So maybe you have some insight on that.
Yeah, I think I do. I can probably help. One of the first things I think as a parent and is we have intuition. And
right, that for sure.
Right, we have that feeling inside. And I think if you can trust that, if something doesn't feel right, it typically isn't. And if you have something, you know, that little red flag, that little warning bell goes off in your head, you know what, my kid is doing something or I'm sensing something isn't right, trust that. Go by that first and you know, do your investigating, you know, check their rooms, you know, get a drug test and get, you know, the one from CVS, I believe, is like a 40 panel. Get something like that. Have them, when they walk in the door, do a drug test for you. Don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid of upsetting your kids. Your kids are not your friends.
Right, exactly.
Right, and that was one of the things, too, is, you know, I was a single mom for a long time, and there's a bit of guilt sometimes associated with that where you think that you want to be friendly with your kids. Yeah, but you're not supposed to be their friend. Don't have them be angry at you sometimes, but at least they're going to be alive.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And change in behaviors, too, right? I mean, just that,
yes,
in general.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. And, you know who their friends are. And definitely, you know, the teenagers in general go through a morph in behavior. You're going to see that. So expect them to, you know, they're going to act out. They're going to, their clothing and the way they dress, and that's going to change. But anything out of the ordinary that seems unusual to you, ask them about it. If you can have open communication with your kids as much as possible, that's important. Don't be afraid to ask your children about what's going on. Monitor their internet. Get them involved in sports, but sports doesn't protect them either.
No, it's amazing. You can't, I think at the end of the day, it's really, it's hard to be fail. I mean, you really, you can't be foolproof. You can't stop them from life happening, and you can't, you know, really, you can't control who they're around, what they're doing. But like you said, to monitor it, to have an open, I think, dialogue, to let them know that honesty is okay. I know with my mom, I only lied to her to protect her when I was younger because I didn't want her to be worried about me. But had she said that it was okay to talk to her about certain things, I mean, in retrospect, my mom and I have had these conversations. But I think, you know, moving forward, I've learned that's so valuable to have a healthy dialogue between you and your child, and they don't feel like they're going to be punished or they're going to be reprimanded per se if they're honest about what they've seen or what their friends are doing or maybe what they're experiencing, what kind of pressure is going on around them. And that way, you know, we could get them the best resources. We can kind of comfort them or educate them as needed.
I agree. And also, I think if they are at risk, because there is a genetic predisposition, that
sure.
is a huge factor. And if they are at risk, if you or your husband or your aunts and uncles, if there is a predisposition there, talk about that and be open about your own, right? And be open about your own past. If you have a history of struggling yourself, you know, I think parents who sit there and don't talk about their own personal struggles, you don't have to go into detail, of course, but if you actually say, you know what, I've had my own, you know, I guess, struggle in a way with this, and this is the reason why you probably should be really wary of drinking and experimenting, because it could become really dangerous for you. Having an open dialogue about that is really important, because they're more likely to go down a really dark path a lot quicker than somebody else, and they need to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so wise and really great advice for people to have that discussion with them. And so you yourself are you're a therapist, you're an art therapist, and you're a published author. How did all this come about? Do you mind sharing a little bit about your personal story of how you got into the field?
Not at all. I got my degree in social work at USC, and I graduated in 2014. And while I was in graduate school, I was trying to decide what classes I was going to take. And my brother, the mother of his children, he has two young girls that are both born to the mother of a meth addict. And I found that out when I was in grad school, and I became very passionate about about substance abuse. And yeah, so that really kind of, you know, I guess steered my career, what I was going to do when I finished school.
Right.
And I started in treatment after I finished school. And you know, I've just kind of followed my path since then. I myself am not in recovery. I've been very, very blessed. But I also don't believe that anybody really out there is free of addiction in some way or form. I think we have a very addictive culture. I think we're culture of addiction. And I think that when people, because I think that's kind of who we are as a culture. So, you know, if we look around at, you know, the way American society is, we're perpetuated by addiction.
Absolutely.
And yeah, very much. And so I've been very fortunate to work with amazing people. I work with Daniel Hedrick, Dr. Daniel Hedrick, and I work, I've art therapy, I've integrated that into my practice. I find that is a great way for people to communicate non-verbally because, you know, as they get to integrate themselves and get to find their identity again through and discover themselves, that's a great way to communicate. I've got a very complicated story. I can go on for hours. I'm trying to kind of pick out the bits that might be important. jumping, you know, way back, I've been in this country for 21 years. I'm originally from Australia, and I think I might still have a little bit of an accent.
Yes, I love it. I love it. It's fantastic. I think this is the first Aussie we've had on, so this is your number one.
Oh, really? Yeah. But yeah, I've been here for 21 years, and I was still slightly there. Yeah, but if you had heard me 21 years ago, I don't know if you'd be able to understand me back then. It was
That's fantastic. Just a really quick about art therapy, just for people that don't understand what that is. You know, I've obviously experienced it since I've worked at treatment centers for many, many years, and the value of kind of I what I see it as is kind of exercising that part of your brain, building that muscle to be creative again, to think outside the box, to allow, it's almost meditative in a sense for people. And I think it's a great way to tap into that part of yourself that has probably been turned off for a long time. And I know, you know, some people say, oh, well, I was creative. I was, you know, I did this or I did that, but not, you know, if you were creative, it was probably in a fog or under the influence of something. And this, I think, is just really powerful in building that muscle again.
I agree. And I think also there's a lot of emotions and there's a lot of feelings that we experience that don't necessarily have a word to express them. And I think that when you're and especially when you're very young, and I also look at addiction as part of an attachment disorder. And so there's a lot of experiences that we have when we're very young that we don't have words for because we don't have language to express ourselves at that age. So when you're using art to express those, you're reintegrating both left and right hemispheres, and you're able to express, you know, some of these feelings that you don't have words for. And we don't even really ask, you know, you to necessarily explain, but just the process itself is cathartic and healing. And that's what, you know, people come away from that experience and they're just feeling so much better about themselves. Or they're just feeling like they've let something go, and that itself is really important.
Absolutely. So valuable. And you just said that addiction is what you think to be an attachment disorder. Can we talk about that for a moment? Because I've been hearing attachment theories lately, and it's really interesting to me. And for people that may be out there just like myself and hearing this, could you possibly expand on what that is, or how you learned about that, or
it's part of something that we discussed a lot when I was in graduate school. And part of I don't have a lot of time, but attachment during the first 5 years, first 5 years of life with a primary caregiver, and it's how you attach with that primary caregiver. And there's different types of attachment, whether it's healthy or unhealthy, basically. And it'll depend on later on in life. It'll express later on in life. And it's also dependent on that attachment, whether you'll, you know, can express mood disorders, personality disorders, so on and so forth. But the brain is forming, and it's it'll basically, you know, as far as addiction goes, if you have a maladaptive attachment, then, you know, you're going to express that later in life. So that's kind of where I'm going with that. But it's yeah. you know, we need a whole show to talk about attachment.
Actually. Yeah, yeah.
And because it's really, really interesting that everybody has their way of attaching and mm-hmm. their relationships are expressed that way later in life as well. But if
Absolutely.
You look at addiction, basically what addiction is it's trying to fill something. And, you know, if you've got like a maladaptive attachment, then you've got like this emptiness going on inside.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, right? So that's what, you know, that's what addiction is doing. And
absolutely, yeah.
Right, yeah. right. But, yeah, we need a whole show.
Yeah, we do, for sure, for sure. And I would love to have you back on to discuss this because I know, you know, I have some people on that discuss healthy relationships or relationships in general. And I think that there's a lot of talk around attachment and relationships that you do have as an adult, romantic relationships, friendships, things like that, too. You know, and also issues of abandonment and issues of not being good enough. And all of this, I think it's all interrelated. You know, when we talk about addiction, too, a lot in my practice, I like for my clients to understand what their core injuries are, some of those things that we tell ourselves or have gotten told, you know, at a younger age that, like you said before, maybe subconscious or conscious, but to really explore those to understand what that hole is or what that, you know, that injury is that we're trying to heal of some kind. So I guess that could be, you know, compounded by attachment issues. It could be compounded by the genetic predisposition. It could be compounded by the group you hang out with and the environment you're in. You know, it just so many things lead to being addicted. And like Joe and I were talking, your co-host, which we'll get to about the radio show. In the last segment, we're all talking about adults addicted to like ADD medicine, like Ritalin or Adderall. And he was just saying how he sees a lot of females that have been addicted to that to lose weight. And I think some people start doing speedy drugs to lose weight at a young age. I've had clients come in and talk about that's how they got started. So there's always a story. There's always something. Everyone has their own individual story of how the substance entered their lives. And it's just a matter of how it became something that was habitual or dependency and then obviously an addiction.
Yeah, yeah. And I did my internship with adolescents. And so 13 to 15-year-olds, yeah, for 2 years. And I saw a lot of adolescents that were prescribed ADD medication or they were turning to marijuana to self-medicate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it starts, too. So then when I got to this part of my career and I'm working in treatment, I saw an interesting trend of individuals that were diagnosed earlier in life with ADD or ADHD. And so I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to do it. And I'm sure it's already been done. I just haven't found it yet. But a study linking the two, because I think that there's probably an overdiagnosis of ADHD back in the day, and then people who think they have it and they're self-medicating with marijuana.
Right. Well, so, absolutely. Yeah. That would be an interesting thing to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you are the co-host of the Recovery Show on KOCI. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you like being, you know, having a radio show and being on air like that live? I think I was lucky enough to be on it recently with Joe, and I guess he had some other co-hosts that evening. But it was so fun and nice to have people, you know, call in. And I know it's a little bit different than, you know, live radio shows like that on FM is a little different than podcasts or things like that. How are you liking it?
I'm having a blast. I think it's a great opportunity to get the word out. And the reason that Joe and I did it in the first place is to raise awareness and educate and have a forum for people to call in and discuss something that really isn't, kind of like what you do as well, which is fabulous, to give people
Thank
an opportunity
you.
To talk about addiction. Yeah. And just talk about something that is kind of controversial, first of all, topics that are a little taboo, and let's get people educated, because I think that one of the things about addiction is that there's still this there's still people that have this attitude towards it that there's a lot of misunderstanding, and you know, if you think about some of the policies that people are trying to push out there and some of the attitudes towards some of the you know, like the sober living homes and treatment centers and things like that out there. You only have to kind of look at, you know, some of the attitudes towards that, and you know that there's just still ignorance. And we're trying to just kind of remove that. And I think the only way you can do that is through education.
Yeah, Absolutely. And do you find that, like you said, it's controversial to discuss addiction, but I do think, you know, and obviously there is a stigma, and a lot of you know, there's a lot of assumptions that come with the word addiction and images that people see or people hear. But like you were saying before, even though you're not in recovery, I think everybody knows someone that is, someone close to them or a friend of a friend or a family member or something like that. And I do think that the discussion, and as somebody that hosts a radio show like yourself, that it's changing a little bit. I feel like there's been a paradigm shift in a sense, and whether that's because it's you know, we hear it in the media or people are dying, you know, like Prince and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we have Michael Jackson, and I mean, this, I could go on and on, Whitney Houston. I mean, it's just it's now a little bit more, I think, in the media and the news, but in general too, I think because there's so many wonderful treatment programs out there, there's advertisements on TV, you hear about it everywhere, that you, I see billboards on the street even, you know, I think it's a little bit more in your face, which I think is helping. Would you say so?
I think it is helping, but I also think on the flip side of that, that we have to be really, really careful that the right treatment centers, the right sober living homes, and that it is regulated. Because like anything, when something blows up like this, we get people and people in there that go after for the wrong reasons. So I also see the flip side of that, where there are good reasons for people to be wary of it. Because, right, so as long as we get the right people and continue to have the right people, the right treatment centers, the right sober living, the right people, right doctors, and all that kind of stuff in there, and we keep it as pure as we can so that we're helping people and not hurting people, I'm good with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, and I've talked about this a lot with professionals that come on the show, that we do have to be responsible for what information we give. I mean, there is so many unsavory treatment centers out there that maybe aren't living up to certain standards and a code of ethics around their treatment programs, but there are a lot of great places out there, and so I just encourage people always to try and find some path towards help, you know, whatever that is, and you know, there's, they could call any of the centers that I work at or you work at, or, you know, anywhere. I think that's why I like to have reputable people on the show and give them access to really good treatment. So and so can you tell us a little bit about the center that you are the clinical director of? It's Tres Vistas, right? Drug and alcohol?
Definitely. I work with Dr. Daniel Hedrick, and he's been in the industry for, I think it's 29 years. He's got a long, extensive history as an addiction specialist, and so it's been an honor to be a part of his team. And we have a treatment center here in San Clemente. It's a small, six-bed boutique place. And we're expanding here shortly. We have access to IV and AD therapy, which he does in addition to.
I'm sorry. What? I couldn't hear you. Yeah. Can you?
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're getting muffled, so I just didn't understand.
Oh, okay, no problem. No, that's
there,
okay. IV and AD therapy, in addition to the detox. IOT, OT, the whole extensive therapy all the way through. And, so we do the whole treatment here. And we do individual therapy, group therapy. We have a chef on staff. It's a beautiful house facility here that I'm located at. And, we have the information I can probably pass on to you that maybe we can, I think it's on the information that we're emailing out, I believe, website, all that kind of good stuff. So
you could give, if you want to give that, anybody listening that's curious, if you want to give the website or the number, you could give it now. That'd be great.
Oh, okay. The it's TraceVistasRecovery.com that people can check it out. And the phone number is on the website.
Okay, so, Tres Vistas, T-R-E-S Vistas, V-I-S-T-A-S, just so if people can't hear.
Uh-huh.
Tres Vistas Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center in San Clemente, California. Yeah, thank you so much. And as a program director, just really quick, you know, keeping people to 30 to 90 days, would you say 90 is probably a little bit better, would you say,
for
longer term?
I don't think 30 days should even be an option personally.
Okay, good. I just didn't want to over. Yeah, I'm all for that too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, after 30 days, you're just beginning to see, you know, clarity. Your brain is just, and 90 days is when your brain heals, and we even have a 90-day brain healing party here.
Oh, fantastic!
We do, just to welcome you back to reality. So, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Angelina Griff. It's been a pleasure to have you, too. And everybody can find Angelina. She's the clinical director at Trace Vista's Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center. And she is the co-host of the Recovery Show on KOCI 101.5 FM with Dr. Joe DeSanto. Thank you so much for being with me today. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.